Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon. You're listening to Ken Hudnall. This is the Ken Hudnall Show, coming to you from our studios right here in exciting El Paso, Texas, gateway to the Old West, the most haunted city in the country. Well, the clown show continues. They're not even bothering the swearing witnesses that the Democrats are calling because they know they're going to lie, so... I mean, it's just getting ridiculous. All of it oriented toward the 2020 election, hoping that Trump's going to be unable to run. So we can have one of that sorry cast of characters the Democrats have put up. We got Biden, who can't remember who did what to who, when, where, and why. We've got Warren, who said, well, she never used her claims of being Native American to her benefit, but she got tenure as the only woman of color at her institution. I don't know if she could tell the truth, if her life depended on it. Well, all that having been said, we're now going to be looking at... some very interesting stories. The in Arizona, the Native American have stories of skinwalkers, which are basically witches, and these witches swoop down and grab likely victims. Now, there was a story that I heard. The guy identified himself as Navajo Joe. He said when he was a kid, he and his uncle went gathering firewood. And it was getting dark, so they were coming back on the dirt road. And the kid had this feeling of being watched. And he started to turn to look out the passenger window, and the uncle yelled, "Don't!" And the kid froze, and then he heard tap, tap, tap on the window. And the uncle kept saying, "Look at me, don't turn away," over and over. The the creatures, these skinwalkers, are considered supremely evil. There was a post on a forum from a young lady. She said she had always been a sensitive and she'd heard things as well. And family moved to Flagstaff, Arizona in 1978, shortly after she graduated high school. And not long after the move, the family decided to go on a road trip back to their home county in Wyoming in the pickup truck to visit friends. Well, Route 163 took them through the Monument Valley Navajo Tribal Park on the reservation. And a friend of theirs who was a Navajo warned them not to travel through the reservation, especially at night. But they made the trip and it was uneventful. So coming back, the strange things happened. It was about 10 p.m. that night when the family was heading back. And it was a long stretch of road, and it was pitch black. They could only see a few feet beyond the headlights on this moonless night. Father was driving, and she and her mother were in the cab beside him, and her brother was sitting in the back of the pickup. Then they crossed the black. Well, she and her mother looked out the back window, and headlights appeared over the crest of a hill, and then disappeared as the car went down, and then it reappeared as cars normally do, and then began to thunder. So the father decided the brother should get inside the cab, so they opened the window between the cab and the back, and the brother crawled in. He was rather young. Well, the girl kept looking back for that car, and she couldn't see the lights. And they rounded a tight corner in the road, and the father slowed down. And that moment, he said, the atmosphere in the truck changed. The mother screamed, and the father cried out, Jesus, what the hell's that? Well, the girl didn't have any idea what was happening. And the brother was yelling, what is it? What is it? The father immediately flipped on the inside light, and she had never seen her father that scared in her entire life. He was white as a sheet. Well, as the pickup truck sped around the corner, the father hit the brakes to stop the truck from going into the ditch, and something leaped out of the ditch. It was black and hairy and tall enough it was an eye level to him. And if it was a man, she said it was like no man she'd ever seen. And despite its monstrous appearance, whatever it was, it did wear men's clothes. A blue and white check shirt and jeans. Its arms were raised over its head, and its eyes were yellow, and its mouth was open. Well, they raced away from the thing and drove all the way home with the interior lights on. A couple of nights later, she and her brother woke up by what sounded like drumming. They looked out the bedroom window in their backyard, which was surrounded by a tall fence and had a forest behind them. And at first, they couldn't see anything, but then the sound of drumming got louder, and they saw a group of men appear behind the fence. It looked like they were trying to climb the fence, but they couldn't manage to climb it. It was so high, and so they began to chant. A few days later, she asked a Navajo friend about that strange and frightening night, and the friend told it was a skinwalker that night on the road, and she added that the men who had come to her house had been chanting been skinwalkers as well, and they wanted her family. But they couldn't get access because something was protecting them. Well, in June of 1987, in a rocky wooded hillside area behind a medical center in Flagstaff, body of a mutilated woman was found. And that began one of the strangest criminal cases in history. She was a 40-year-old Navajo woman found by concerned co-workers who went out looking for her. She was naked and had sustained numerous stab wounds to her upper body. Her left breast had been partially bitten off. Her face was battered and bruised so badly that it was hard to recognize her. She was later confirmed to be the missing housekeeper of the medical center, and she'd been working the night shift before she vanished. Her name was Sarah Saganitzo, and she left behind a 4-year-old son. It was the first time she'd worked the night shift. Her coworkers had been searching for her after her car was found in the medical center car park the next morning, but there was no sign of her. When the local Flagstaff newspaper, The Courier, reported on the discovery of her body, described her as suffering a violent death. Body had been found between rock crevices on a wooded hillside. Now, she had worked at the medical center for over 15 years. Her co-worker and friend, Helen Jaramillo, who was a cook in the medical center, was the one that came across the shocking sight of her friend's naked and bloodied body. Said the only way she could tell was her friend was from her hair. Newspaper quoted police reports as saying the victim had last been seen Friday by a caretaker at the center at about 10:55 p.m., 5 minutes before the end of her shift. Well, when she didn't arrive home to take care of her small son, friends and relatives began looking for her. About 11:30 the next morning, a missing persons report had been filed. Jaramillo said the car was still in the car park, and she couldn't understand why she'd have been walking west of the medical center, and that was the direction her body was found. First thing I wondered was whether it was somebody who knew her pretty well, and if that person had took her out of the building. It's very poorly lit on the west side of the building. Fran said after receiving some training classes, the murdered woman had been newly assigned to the late shift, and this had been her first one. Police Sergeant Pascal Macias said that she suffered an operation made by a sharp instrument believed to be a knife. Autopsy reports indicated she died of suffocation, though, although Macias said that the exact method of this had not yet been determined. 3 months later, a suspect was arrested for the killing. Former Northern Arizona University teacher George Abney was being held in a county jail without a bond after he confessed to police he was the killer. Well, this stunned his former students and teachers alike. He had first apparently confessed to killing the hospital worker in a phone call he placed from his mother's house to his pastor at the church he attended. Reverend Floyd Patterson of the Flagstaff Tabernacle Church later testified that Abney, a member of his congregation, had told him he had dreamed of the killing and was having trouble sorting out reality from his dreams. Prior to this, Police Sergeant Macias said the teacher made statements in regard to the murder. A friend of the teacher said he'd claimed to have dreamed about the murder before it happened. And the man, who wished to remain anonymous for fear of his own safety, told the newspaper he'd been friends with the teacher for 18 months, and he and another friend by the name of George Bellis were with the teacher at the time the woman was said to have been murdered. He said that when he told the police this, they accused him of lying and of trying to protect his friend. The man said the police told him the teacher had already confessed. Well, his friend said he didn't know if the teacher had confessed, but believed he was being railroaded into confessing to something he didn't do, and that they were acting like headhunters and had arrested him just to have somebody in custody. And quite often the police do, in fact, do that. He said his friend couldn't have done it. He and Bellis were with him, and he was a quiet, intelligent, and controlled person. Never lost his temper. If something happened, he would figure it out. If he needed help, he'd help you. He was very quiet. There was no way he did it. He added the former teacher was stressed about school and work and that perhaps his dreams had caused him to become confused. He said Abney had told his friend Bellis he'd been having dreams of the murder happening before it had happened. His friend and I worried that this made him think he'd done it and had confessed to it. His minister, Patterson, said he believed the teacher just had prophetic dreams inspired by God. He said Abney had predicted events in other people's lives as well. Students he had taught offered varying opinions about their teacher. Newspaper quoted anonymous students as saying their teacher was a strange character and a little strange, with one student relating to the Arizona Sun newspaper how he was a fairly good teacher, but he told strange stories about his childhood in class. Head of the English department at the university, Dr. Paul Ferlazzo, said he was a serious and conscientious teacher. He was a quiet person. Well, in July of 1988, 1 year later, the jury at the Coconino County Superior Court found him innocent of the first-degree murder of Sarah Saganitzo. The jury deliberated for about 4 hours, considered the prosecution arguments that teeth marks found on the deceased woman's breast matched the teacher's teeth. And this is where it starts getting strange, if it wasn't strange enough already. The jury also considered a highly unusual defense argument The defense argued because her body had been found with a broken stick lying over her neck and a clump of grass and earth had been placed beside her truck, which was traced back to the cemetery, then the murderer, the defense insisted, rather than being the teacher, could in fact be a skinwalker. Now, this was a unique defense theory and required the court to recognize the validity of the skinwalker. They also argued it could have been her former boyfriend, indicating they believed he was the skinwalker because he was Navajo and his alibi was he'd been in a sweat lodge at the time of her murder. This defense, unique though it was taken into account by the jury and he was acquitted. When it was announced that he was not guilty, the victim's sister, Rosemarie Williams, said she has no doubt about his innocence and stated she believed the killer was certainly still at large. Her husband told the Prescott Courier he believed the teacher was innocent and added he now considered the teacher a friend. As for the police, they still believed the teacher was the killer, while the defense stuck to their explanation that a skinwalker had been responsible. It's believed to have been one of the very few times a skinwalker had been offered as a suspect in a court of law. But the jury accepted it. Well, it was pointed out that there may be more going on than a potential skinwalker. There are some murder cases, including the one we just discussed, occurred in Coconino County. Two of the cases took place 16 years apart, one in 1987, Douglas Goss, and one in 2003, Deborah Dog Doe, and she's never been identified, by the way, that's why they call her Doe. Both victims were beaten to death and dumped in Williams, Arizona, on a road by the name of Devil Dog Road. Efforts to identify the Devil Dog Jane Doe have included numerous interactions with law enforcement agencies, both nationally and internationally. Well, the first case, Douglas Goss, he was 28, left his brother a note saying he's going to find a way to get from Guerneville, California, to his mother's house in Glendale, Arizona, in August of 87. Coconino County Sheriff's Office deputies found his body on the forest just off Devil Dog Road near Williams on August 30th, killed by a blow to the head with a blunt object. Killer never identified. Murder weapon hadn't been identified. Goss was unemployed and was staying with his brother for 2 weeks, and then his brother's going to drive him to their mother's house in Glendale, Arizona. Instead of waiting on his brother, though, Goss decided to leave a note on August 16th saying he'd find a way to get there on his own. Well, he never got there, and the brother filed a missing persons report September 11th. He didn't know that county deputies had found a body with no identification in the forest just off Devil Dog Road near Williams on August 30th. Body was that of a man who'd been killed with a blunt instrument to the head. Body was later identified as being Goss, but not until mid-December. The initial inquiry into the theft of his suitcase is unique, according to Joe Sumner, volunteer investigator for the Coconino County Sheriff's Office. Sumner, who retired from the National Park Service in 2007 as a criminal investigator, came on to the cold case unit. Yes, the National Park Service has a cold case unit. In 2008, Goss's body was decomposed and found 200 yards south of Interstate 40 and about 150 feet off Devil Dog Road. They think his date of death was August 18th, just 48 hours after he left his brother. Well, Devil Dog Road was the location of another dead body found in October 2003. This time it was a female whose body was laid to rest in Potter's Field after it was unable to be identified. Her murder is also unsolved. In fact, the grave is unmarked. She'd also been held in the head and her body dumped there without clothes or ID. Hunters out on the first day of deer hunting season found her body about 200 yards near camp. Devil Dog Doe, as she was nicknamed, and lots of dental work done prior to her death, estimated to have cost about $20,000 at the time. And she had beautifully manicured nails. Body was found with a bite mark on her right arm. I would point out that the skinwalker victim, Sarah Saganitzo, also had bite marks on her breast. Advances in DNA could apparently now make it possible to distinguish who made the bite, and if this is the case, then presumably the police should have done this, and the killer's DNA is not currently held in any police database, which would mean that the person who committed the murders has never been arrested for any criminal behavior. Hunters discovered her body, which had been there from anywhere between a couple of days to 2 weeks, after one of them fired a shot at a deer and came up on her body in the wooded area. Drag marks indicated her body had been pulled along the ground for about 70 feet. She'd got a fatal blow to her head and been left face down. There was little blood at the scene, which indicated she'd most likely been killed someplace else and then dumped there. She had eaten approximately 3 hours before her death and had been dead for about 3 days when she was found. They estimated her age was between 45 and 65, but they've yet to identify her. Well, when I did a talk at the Necronomicon in Santa Fe, I was asked what I knew about the mysterious disappearances in the state parks. Well, apparently there have been a number of them. One of them was a man named Peter Jackson. He initially, they had a full-scale search going on for him, but that was changed to limited continuous status after becoming inclement weather was forecast. It was October 2nd, 2016, Yosemite National Park, or Yosemite, depending on your point of view. And after searching for the missing man, it has now been called to a halt. Limited continuous meant that the field search was now stopped, but any clues or information that came in, regardless of the whereabouts of the missing man, would be followed up on. Now, Mr. Jackson was 74 years old, and he had sent a text to his son on the 17th of September telling him he was en route to the national park. His vehicle was later found at White Wolf campsite, and it was discovered that he'd paid for his camping up until the 21st of September. Believed he'd gone on a day hike from the campsite but never came back. Wasn't known what trail he took. There were a number, and although it was believed he usually undertook hikes rated as moderate to strenuous, usually within a 5 mile length. Even though he was in his 70s, he was in peak physical condition, had no medical problems. Well, he's still missing. No evidence has been found to indicate where he'd gone or where his body was now. From National Park Service records, the search for Alexander Seaver was also changed from active to limited continuous after searches have failed to find him. He was listed as missing after failing to return from a day hike in Yosemite in June of 2017. He was also rated as very physically fit and a frequent solo hiker. He was active duty Navy. Last seen at housekeeping camp at the beginning of May. National Park Service were appealing for any witnesses who might have seen him in the area since that time. Search efforts were listed as comprising of rangers looking on all the popular hiking trails, trained dogs, helicopter and civilian volunteers. It's known he spent the previous few days hiking around the valley area of the national park on his own with no issues. His disappearance is still a mystery. Let's look at Floyd Roberts III, went missing inside Grand Canyon National Park in June of 2016. He was a 52-year-old Caucasian male, last seen, according to the National Park Service, wearing a red long-sleeve shirt and jeans and carrying a backpack and a day pack. According to the National Park Service, he became separated from his friends at about 4:45 p.m. during an extremely hot day during a hike in a remote part of the Grand Canyon on the Siwits Plateau. This day's hikes have been one of a series of planned hikes over the course of their 9-day planned trip. Following an intensive 6-day search effort, the park police said the incident remains unresolved. Search for Roberts is in continuous limited mode in which rangers and pilots are continuing to search for clues when in the area with with no additional clues to guide search efforts. On Friday, high school teacher Roberts was with friends and family when he went missing on day one of their trip. His friend, Ned Bryant, reported him missing to the National Park Service. He had set out together along with Bryant's daughter, Madeline, for another trip through the canyon. The group reached a trailhead on a hill and they decided to split up and take different routes. He and the daughter went one way and the school teacher went another. Now, Bryant wrote to his wife, Heidi Bryant, on Facebook, said, "I'm very worried. Everything is going perfectly until the split." Excuse me. But even helicopters couldn't find any sign of him. You know, sometimes strange things are seen in the woods. There were two rangers who went out on a search and rescue. Missing person was a man in his 20s. He'd gone hiking and hadn't returned the day he intended to, and when they got the call, it was night, but they hiked in a few miles and set up camp on a ridge that had a pretty good view. He had gone into the woods prepared, so they decided to wait till daylight before beginning the search. About 2 in the morning, one of the rangers got up to go to the bathroom and saw a moving light a few miles away at the base of the cliff across the valley. It was clear it was a flashlight, but the two made the decision to keep waiting for daylight. Following morning, they decided to go and check out the area where they'd seen this light and bring the guy home. So they got to where the ranger had seen the light the night before and started to call his name. Well, they found his body at the base of the cliff. His body was mangled. He'd fallen 60 feet and landed on his head. They radioed back. It had now become a recovery instead of a rescue. And at this point, the other ranger calls the first one to come take a look. And 20 feet from the man's body was his flashlight. When the coroner got there, he examined the man, said he'd been dead at least 48 hours before they found the body. Well, the ranger knew that wasn't possible because they'd seen the flashlight the night before. And there were no other campers, no other hikers. To this day, he has no idea what he saw that night. Now, if you want to be involved in the discussion, pick up the phone and call 267-521-0159. There was another account. The individual telling the story was 22 at the time. And spending the week alone in the campground in Banff National Park in the Rocky Mountains. In fact, the one telling the story was the only person renting a lot there. It was completely empty but for him. On the third night, he heard something outside his tent, right by his head. It sounded like a hoof rhythmically falling on the ground, not stomping. And he thought whatever he was hearing and sensing was aware of him. He said he lit some candles. Finally, he fell asleep. Next day, he woke up to light rain and it's pitch black, and quickly he remembered what happened the night before and realized he wasn't alone. And there are now two hoofs he can hear falling gently near his head. He felt himself being stared at through the tent canvas. So he lit some more candles, but he didn't fall asleep till dawn. When he got up the next morning, he saw a log had been taken from the firewood pile and placed upright about 5 feet from the tent entrance. Now, that campground was surrounded by a 6-foot-tall electrified bear fence. He was the only person in that camping lot. Well, this next story came out of 40 and Times magazine. 1986, he was studying engineering at Brooklyn's Technical College in Weybridge, Surrey. One evening, he was walking along the path from college to the train station. Now, normally that footpath would have been full of students eager to get home, but for some reason, he was alone. About a third of the way along the path, he decided he had to relieve himself against a tree. Well, as he did so, he looked back to see if anybody was coming. It was twilight, but there was enough light to see. Someone was coming over the brow of the hill, but too far away to worry about, so he continued. Looked back again and noticed the figure gained about 30 yards. Thought there might be somebody on a bike to travel that distance so quickly. Took another glance before finishing, and the figure gained a lot of ground. He walked back to the path, took another glance, thinking he should have heard the chain or the tires. He confronted by what can only be described as the Grim Reaper. It was over 8 feet tall, wearing a black cloak that hung over its body in a triangular shape with a hood over the face. He realized that every time he had seen that figure, he'd been motionless, as it was this time. Well, there was another individual who wrote a surprisingly similar story in 1999. He was living in Roslindale, Massachusetts. His house bordered the Arnold Arboretum, a park with fields and forest. He spent a lot of time in there walking and biking. At about dusk one evening, he was walking down from on top of one of the hills, and the landscape in front was mostly field with occasional trees. Paved path runs around one side of the hill, and he was headed toward the path and singing softly to himself as he came down and he became aware of someone else in the vicinity. Looking up, he saw someone moving at great speed along the path coming to the left. Well, something struck him as strange about that figure. It was moving way too fast to have been walking, so he assumed he was on a bike. The problem was that there was no sound of tires or gears shifting, nothing. And why would somebody ride a bicycle while wearing a long, dark, black cloak? He was big and skimmed along without any evidence of a bike. He stared fixedly ahead, and since their paths were at a 90-degree angle, he never saw his face clearly, just a hood covering it. The cloak had one unusual feature. His eyes wouldn't stay focused, and when he looked at it, they would blur. He remembered thinking he must be seeing things and closed his eyes for a second or two. When he opened, the figure was still there and passed right in front of him. And then he simply vanished. When they walked around for a while to see if the figure dodged behind a tree or veered suddenly off course, but there was no sign. His first thought was he had seen the Grim Reaper on a bicycle. Well, there's been a number of cases of strangeness, figures like that being seen. There was this next story came from MUFON. That's a report from a witness who was out on Lake Michigan with her husband and a group of friends, April 16, 2017. Now, they were celebrating one of their birthdays and were having a great time when one of them spotted something in the sky above them. They were about 2 miles out on the lake, and the witness looked up and saw what looked like a giant bat. It was as tall as her husband, she said, who was 6'4". Blacker than the night sky, it was solid black with eyes that seemed to reflect the moonlight. Circled the boat 3 times in total silence before flying away, blended in the night, and it was gone. 5 minutes later, a bright green object was moving across the horizon. It wasn't a plane. It was bright green. It was moving slowly. And after it disappeared from sight, they all just sat there in silence, just stunned. Well, this next story, it's about a 20-year-old Humboldt University student named Michael Madden. He was going to become a forest ranger. August 10th, 1996, he'd made plans to meet his friends at Sandbar Flat on the Stanislaus River near Sonora in the Stanislaus National Forest in California. They're going to go fishing and camping. Spot at which he and his father camped many times before when he was growing up, and he was very familiar with the area. When his friends arrived at the spot, at about 2 a.m. on August 12th. They were surprised to find no sign of him. But his camping and fishing gear was there along with a freshly made fire. He said not long after that, a man walked up. He's carrying a 45 automatic, and they asked the group of friends, "Are you looking for Mikey?" Well, this individual stood there and began to cock the gun repeatedly. He stayed there for hours that night. He appeared to be wearing boots and looked very much like the ones that Mike wore. So after this, did his friends officially reported him missing? Police arrived and scoured the area extensively with search and rescue and volunteers, dogs, divers. But there were no clues to the young man's whereabouts found. 4 days later, his own dog returned to the spot where he had built the fire, dehydrated, but was unable to lead the searches to where Michael might be. The man who'd repeatedly cocked his pistol was identified as Joseph Tyne. He was given a polygraph test. Police never arrested him. His gun had no spent shells. After the fact, the friends want to know how this man knew Michael's name and why did he call him Mikey, a name none of his friends called him. According to reports from the B newspaper, at the time of the young man's disappearance, some witnesses said they had seen him sitting along the banks of the river the day that he got there with his dog. His friend arrived the next day. Couldn't find him. And this was believed to have been the last sighting of him. There was a campfire lit, one of his friends told the police and the newspaper reporters at the time. And then this creepy guy jumps out of the bushes and says, "What are you doing here?" And asks him if they were looking for Mikey. Well, Michael's stepbrother, Randy Powell, said the police reports at the time included statements from witnesses who told authorities that Michael had been seen at a cabin near an area called Pinecrest rather than Sandbar on the day he disappeared. As for the police, they decided he was probably murdered. Over the years, there was still no body showing up and no further evidence to go on. Everybody wondered, had he fallen victim to a random killer? Or even a serial killer such as the then unknown Kerry Stainer, who was later convicted of killing several hikers in the Yosemite National Park, which was about an hour away from this location. In fact, his father, who had called the local reporters over the passing years, often in tears because he couldn't understand why no breaks in his son's case, and calling the police when searches were being carried out for the missing tourist in a national park. Well, unfortunately, the father died without ever finding out what happened to his son. It was suggested he might have fallen into the river, but even though divers came in and thorough searches were conducted, no body was found. In May of 2016, a person out walking saw what turned out to be human remains. Investigators from the county sheriff's office later confirmed they were human remains, but they could have belonged to any number of people who had vanished at the same spot. Well, the Modesto Bee listed a number of people who had mysteriously disappeared there, as well as Michael. August of 2005, Ms. Nita Mayo, a 67-year-old lady from Hawthorne, Nevada, disappeared in that same area. Her car was found at Donald Vista Point. Her purse and cell phone were inside, along with a receipt from a general store 10 miles away. But when the dog searched that area, they picked up no scent ever other than right there at the car. Search teams found no trace of her and no clues that could indicate where she could have possibly have gone. Strangely, almost like the Madden case, an unidentified man went to the medical clinic where she worked after she disappeared. He showed up at the clinic and claimed he'd heard Ms. Mayo had vanished, but that she'd been found. Well, in fact, she had been found, and the search for her had not even begun at that point. Nobody has any idea who that man was. Missing woman's daughter, Tracy, said he was really weird. He was interviewed and failed a polygraph, but added he wasn't arrested. Then the case went cold. Well, she couldn't let it rest, though. She held on to the possibility this person knew more than the police had told her and Several years after her mother disappeared, she drove to his hometown, showed up at his workplace in Texas. Well, she later told the Modesto Bee she went alone, which probably wasn't smart, and didn't tell him she was coming. But when he saw her, he said, "Hello, Tracy, how are you?" She spoke with him, but when she left, she knew no more than when she set out to question him. He offered nothing that would implicate himself in any way, and she found nothing he said to be incriminating. Well, in April 2014, 46-year-old car was found at the same at that point. By the time the car was found, she'd been missing a week. Police believe she didn't out to meet a friend. Sheriff's office later said on April 20th, the day she disappeared, sent a letter to a friend stating she's going to be doing some hiking up in the area where her car was found. CBS Local Sacramento covered the story. They said the mother of two and owner of the cafe vanished without a trace. At the time, everybody believed she'd left to get groceries for a cafe and that she'd be right back, but she never did come back. Her SUV would later be found abandoned at the remote Vista Point, 30 miles east of Sonora. Her purse was still inside. It was abandoned, the sunroof left open, and it had been rained in. Search and rescue teams found no clues near her car. She was, however, as well as sent two rambling audio tapes to friends. When her father was interviewed, he said he hoped it was just a case that she needed some time away for herself, but as each day passed, his concern grew. October 2016, another person vanished from Donal Vista Point in the Stanislaus National Park. 68-year-old Breck Phelps disappeared while on a fishing trip. Car was found a quarter of a mile away near a trail leading down to the river. Several search and rescue teams joined the search mission, including additional personnel across the entire state. The search effort comprised dog teams, National Guard helicopters with infrared thermal imaging. Phelps was discovered to be missing after a friend became worried about him not returning and drove out to the Vista Point. It was an area that the 68-year-old liked to go to hike and fish, and his friend found his car parked there with no sign of his friend at the scene or near the river. They also searched the river and the reservoir. No sign of a body. Well, not long after, unidentified human remains were found in 2016. To whom the county sheriff's office ruled out any connection between them and any of the missing people. District Ranger Molly Fuller said of the mystery of the place, it's a day-use area, not a campground. You can't stay there overnight. It's dangerous, but there's a lot of dangerous places in the forest. Really no explanation for why people have parked there and disappeared. Well, we have another story about a woman named Joan Grant, a historical novelist who also wrote of the most vivid recollections of past lives she believed she'd had. She was also prone to experiencing things of a more paranormal nature that she couldn't account for. One such incident occurred in the 1920s when she went to the Cairngorms National Park in Scotland. According to her autobiography, Time Out of Mind, she was staying with her husband Leslie at a shooting lodge near Grantown-on-Spey in Scotland in August of 1928. They set out from Lothamurchus in the heart of the national park, intended to climb toward the mountains, but it was such a beautifully hot day that she and her husband opted to lay in the sun and eat a picnic in the forest. Then they took a leisurely stroll before leaving to go back to the hotel. It was too peaceful for serious walking, the husband said later. Well, nothing had been further from her mind than spooks when suddenly she was seized with such terror and panic she turned and ran back up the path. Her husband, completely puzzled by her flight, ran after her, shouting at her, trying to find out what was wrong, and all she would do is scream, "Run!" Something malign, four-legged, yet obscenely human, invisible, but solid enough for her to hear the pounding hooves trying to. She ran for about a half mile when she burst through some invisible barrier, and she knew she was safe while seconds before she'd been in mortal danger. A year later, one of her father's professors described an almost exact experience he'd had. Now, he was a rationalist, but he had been so profoundly startled by the experience he'd written to the newspaper, The Times, and got a letter from another reader who'd been pursued by this thing. Years later, professor told her about two hikers whom search parties had been out for 3 days, and they'd been found dead. He showed her the exact spot on the map in which they'd been found. It was the same place as when her terror began. Both of the men had been under the age of 30. The weather was fine. They'd spent a night under shelter. It was stone shelter and written in the visitor book there. They were found within 100 yards of each other, sprawled face down as though they'd fallen headlong when in flight. Well, a doctor did a post-mortem on them. Never in his life had he seen healthier corpses. There was not a thing wrong with either one of them, except their hearts just stopped. Well, there are quite a number of very mysterious happenings that I guess you could chalk up to the paranormal. The mysterious disappearances in the parks have never been solved. In most cases, they don't even find the bodies. Is it just a coincidence her baffling vanishing took place a stone's throw from a place closely associated with programs designed to make people disappear? None of it makes any sense, according to Carrie Buchero. That's the hardest part. Her mother's body was discovered right near an area that was used for escape and evasion training. She was an experienced hiker in the Appalachians with her hiking partner, another female. They were walking the 2,200-mile Appalachian Trail as part of a bucket list. Now, I've been involved in escape and evasion training. And while it's easy to get lost, there are trails marked. And she was very close to a marked trail. So what happened? That was never figured out. In the UK in 1980, Zygmunt Adamski disappeared from Todmorden in the rural county of Yorkshire, June 6, 1980. 5 days later, his body was located on top of a coal pile in a coal mine. Police arrived, and when they conducted their investigation, they found burn marks on the man's shoulders and neck, and a strange green ointment that was covering the wounds. They were never able to identify what that ointment was. His clothes were clean, despite him having been missing for 5 days, although his jacket had been buttoned up incorrectly and his shirt was missing. There were no footprints in the coal mine. The mine company's son was the last person in the area, but he'd been there before midnight. He had not seen a body on a coal pile. Clearly, it appeared to have been put there sometime after he left. The pathologist ruled his death had occurred between 11 and 1 p.m. of that day, but the burns on his body were determined to have occurred 2 days before his death. Now, the pathologist also said what led to his death couldn't be answered, but he ruled the man had died of a heart attack due to shock or fright, and his face was contorted with fear. Now, the case was never solved. But oddly enough, a few months after finding the man's body, one of the policemen was on the night shift and claimed to experience an unnerving incident himself. Searching for some missing cows, he claimed he saw a strange large object in front of him on the road hovering above the ground. Tried to radio his colleagues, but his radio wouldn't work, so he stayed in his car. He later realized that over half an hour had passed he couldn't account for, and he found the soles of his boots were split open, looking to him as though he'd been dragged across the ground. That same night, other policemen independently called into the headquarters with reports of seeing bright lights descending into the valley. The cows were later discovered in a field which had previously been empty, and the entrance gate to it was locked. The ground was muddy. There were no prints from the cows. Like the man, it was as though they'd literally been dropped in. The policeman himself was so disturbed by his experience, Underwood hit no regression in search of answers about what could have happened to him in that missing half an hour. Under a state of hypnosis, he began to describe being in a room with a black-robed, bearded man with a biblical appearance, accompanied by a huge black dog and other smaller creatures that were the size of five-year-olds and had robotic movements. Well, the interesting thing about this, all of these stories, there are let us say explanations that require us to suspend our belief systems. Now, when I went chasing Sasquatch up in the Four Corners region, a lot of people talked about skinwalkers. And just on the other side of Archuleta Mesa is Skinwalker Ranch, which is a very mysterious area. Well, there's a lot of information about skinwalkers, but you won't find many tribesmen willing to discuss them. It's believed if you talk to a non-Navajo, you may invite the attention of one. There are, well, let's say, many stories of disappearing people. Some people very well known. For example, Agatha Christie vanished for 11 days. Now, her stock in trade was writing about people who disappeared. One of her biographers announced his theory was that she suffered from a fugue state, which her mind was depressed and her body stressed. She was in a trance for days that resulted in amnesia. Now, she'd walked away from her car, her coat, her identification, and frankly, her money. But they found her at a spa hotel using an assumed name. Then we have Anastasia Romanoff, Now, this story has been bandied about since the Russian Revolution. The original story was that during the 1917 attack on the Romanov family, Anastasia and her brother Alexei were presumed missing but not killed, along with her siblings. There was a woman by the name of Anna Anderson who claimed to be the missing Grand Duchess. If that claim had been confirmed, she would be in line for a tremendous fortune, because the Tsar was the wealthiest man in the world. He literally owned Russia. Now, in 1990, her DNA was tested. It was confirmed she was not a Romanov. 1991, a Yekaterinburg grave was discovered. It contained 9 bodies, including some of the Romanov family and some servants. But Alexei and Anastasia were not in the grave. Now, nearby in 07, a second grave was found, and these bones were tested for DNA. Reports found the bones belonged to the Romanov family. And it was believed that these two bodies were the missing children. There have been many prominent people who have vanished over the years. And the problem has been that if you disappear and you're gone for a long period of time, the question becomes, why did you go? Where did you go? Look at Amelia Earhart. The man who was the original inventor of the movie projection, whose name was Le Prince, vanished on a train. Ambrose Bierce. He was a writer, kind of a strange one. Went to Mexico to experience life, Mexican Revolution. And supposedly, he disappeared for good in 1914. 73, when you left Washington, D.C. in October 1913, one of the tours some Civil War battlefields he had fought on. Well, he went from Louisiana to Texas, and he crossed the border to El Paso into Mexico. He wrote back home to say he was in Ciudad Juarez, joining up with Pancho Villa's army to observe what was going on. Well, once again, we come to the end of another show. We'll be back tomorrow night when we'll talk more about unsolved mysteries and mysterious disappearances. Until then, Ken Hudnall for the Ken Hudnall Show saying have a truly great evening.